From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. People across the political spectrum want to improve public schools in North Carolina. We'll hear from a former Democratic state legislator who recommends that the state abandon its top-down approach toward that goal. Now that North Carolina has paid back its multi-billion dollar debt to the federal government for unemployment insurance benefits, lawmakers are now debating how much of a reserve fund they need to avoid debt in the future. Universities have touted the value of academic freedom for centuries. What does that freedom mean in an age of political correctness? Experts inside and outside the academy will weigh in on that question. And we'll discuss a recent review of North Carolina's complicated system of sending state tax dollars to local school systems. Some people want to see a major change in that system. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Two residents of Wallace, North Carolina, who were featured in three Carolina Journal stories earlier this year, are now heading to prison. A federal judge has sentenced the couple for operating a scheme to collect fraudulent federal income tax refunds. But prison is just the beginning for the couple. Carolina Journal's editor-in-chief, Rick Henderson, is here with the story. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
So these folks are going to the federal pokey, as we put it, for how long?
The husband, Perfecto Ruano is his name, is going to prison for 57 months, or has a 57-month term. And his wife, Walda Luna, has an 81-month term.
These are serious prison sentences.
Yes, they are. They're very serious prison sentences. Also, there's a financial penalty involved. They have been ordered to forfeit more than $1.8 million in cash that was discovered in their car when they were involved in a traffic stop in Arkansas.
And we will get to that portion of the story in a moment.
Plus four parcels of property that they own in Duplin County. And $3 million of restitution, and the U.S. Attorney's Office press release wasn't clear if that $3 million also encompasses that cash and property or if that's in addition to the cash and property.
It sounds as if they are wealthy people, and obviously some of this, according to the court, coming from this scheme that they were involved in. Did they appear to be a wealthy couple in Wallace, North Carolina?
No, they lived in a very standard middle-class home in a little country subdivision there in Wallace. They owned a small convenience store, but no, they were not wealthy at all. They generated their wealth by defrauding the taxpayers of the United States.
Carolina Journal has been reporting on this type of fraud for a number of months, more than a year now. And in fact, this couple from Wallace, North Carolina was featured in three stories. Why? What got Carolina Journal onto this couple?
Well, we learned about the couple because of an action that was filed that involved a large number of fraudulent tax returns that were done. What was once known as stolen identity refund fraud, which we've reported about for a couple of years now at CJ, is now called taxpayer identity fraud, is what now the IRS terms it as. And it's a multi-billion dollar a year problem. And we learned about this couple from information that there was about to be an indictment of the couple. That what they had essentially done was fill out fake tax forms, income tax returns from people who did not exist. They had invented taxpayer identification numbers or social security numbers for these people, had filled out returns claiming that they were owed earned income tax credits, and then used five post office boxes in Wallace to collect several thousand checks. And they also, in that convenience store, happened to have a license to be a check cashing service.
Yeah, convenient.
So, yes, indeed.
Really convenient.
Very convenient store. So they were able to launder that money effectively through their own convenience store and also take off a share of that as a fee. So that became instant cash for them. And when the IRS learned about this, then they immediately took care of this. But the IRS found out about it from the traffic stop.
Interesting. Now, tell us about the traffic stop that ended up now this couple going to prison.
They were driving toward Los Angeles to apparently deliver some cash to relatives there. And they were just a routine traffic stop in Arkansas. And I mean, I'm guessing the bundles of currency must have been visible in the back seat or something. That's the only way I could figure that there would be
one
suspicion of that.
One surprised cop.
Well, yeah, I guess so. I guess $2 million in cash because, I mean, it would be the old classic has to be in, small,
unmarked bills.
Unmarked bills because if you think about it, if you're dealing with the banking system and you make deposits of several thousand dollars, if the deposit's more than $10,000, it has to be reported. But even if you make series of deposits of several thousand dollars, that will draw banking officials' attention. And so they probably had to make sure that these transactions were done spaced apart and done in smaller amounts than normal. And so that probably meant they did carry a large amount of cash with them.
You know, we chuckle about this, but obviously it's very serious. And you talk about someone being tipped off. Well, it was this traffic stop. But, Rick, wouldn't, for example, the post office think something was amiss if people were getting all sorts of checks from the Internal Revenue Service? Or wouldn't the bank be tipped off if there were all of these deposits or fake ID numbers? It seems like all sorts of different government agencies should have been tipped off.
Well, right now, we don't know what the post office had to say about this because the post office basically has just let this go by. And we haven't had any kind of information from the post office there because I'm imagining they don't get a large volume of mail at Wallace. But what we do know is that the IRS is under an incredible amount of pressure to issue refund checks as quickly as possible because people like to get their money back when they fill out their tax returns. And so the IRS has not required there to be verification that a person who is requesting a tax refund have any kind of record of filing in previous years, for instance. There's no third-party verification that a person who is filing for an income tax refund actually exists.
That's an incredible statement. So, and I think many of our listeners will be surprised
by
that.
That's why taxpayer identity fraud is such a big deal, because what happens is people file their tax returns. They file their tax returns as soon as they get their W-2 forms, which has to be by the end of January. They go to they file electronically or they mail in their tax return, and the refund usually comes within a matter of a few weeks. And it's only at the end of March that these things have to be cross-checked. So by then, if you're running a scheme like this and you're doing it not on such a large scale but on a smaller scale, it's quite possible to collect tens of thousands of dollars in fraudulent refunds and then disappear before anybody can actually verify that this is happening. People often do this, say, with companies that deal with a lot of temporary labor, such as construction firms and things like this. They'll find a company that hires lots of seasonal or temporary workers. They'll get that company's taxpayer identification number and then use that as the basis for filing fraudulent returns. The company quite often is completely innocent in this case. But in the instance of Luano and Luna, in this particular instance, this was a scheme that was set up in whole cloth just by them.
Let's presume that they're going to be serving their federal prison sentence, complete their terms. What happens to them when they get out of prison?
Well, Ms. Luna is not a legal resident of the United States, and so she will be subject to be deported at the time that her prison term is over. Mr. Ruano is a legal resident, but as I say, and they also have children as well in the U.S., but there's likely to be a deportation hearing and sentencing at that point too.
Rick, do we have any idea how prevalent this type of theft is?
The IRS has called it the number one tax fraud problem in the country, and there are estimates of anywhere from $5 to $10 billion a year worth of fraud that takes place like this. As I say, most of these are small-time operations involving a dozen or so But this was a massive one involving hundreds, if not thousands, of fraudulent returns. $12 million was the total that was found by the IRS. That's just what they discovered.
Just incredible. And, of course, you can read the story about the federal prison sentence, and the stories are there as well. We've linked them for you if you want to read the background on how Carolina Journal has been reporting not only on this couple and the allegations against them going back months and months and months, but this problem in general. You can read it all at carolinajournal.com. Rick Henderson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. There's plenty of disagreement about how to do it, but most everyone wants to see North Carolina's public schools perform better. Our next guest has approached that challenge from a number of perspectives. Marcus Brandon has been a state legislator, and now he serves as executive director of Carolina Can. It's a nonprofit education policy and advocacy organization. He recently addressed the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society on this theme: poverty, policy, and participation, a path to better public schools. I don't think I popped my peas too much on that. Thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, before we get into what Carolina Can is doing and the perspective you want to share with folks, given your background as a legislator, as someone who's worked on public school issues, what do you see as the big challenges?
I do see as the big challenge is one of the things that you read. It's policy, politics, and participation. But I do think that participation is a big problem that we have in North Carolina in terms of, like, building capacity. I always say that you can make policy, and I've certainly been involved in that. But policy for me is a place where we have access for people to participate, to make things better. Now, we take, for example, we have a charter school policy. Underneath that charter school policy, we have great charter schools and we have schools that are not so great. It's all under the same policy. It's the people that make those charter schools great. It is the people that make our voucher program great. And private schools are not just great because we have a policy that it now accepts low-income students. It's great because of the people that make it work for those low-income students. And so that, to me, is something that we've come together in North Carolina, and we've done an excellent job over the last 6 years of creating more choice and an environment that's more free market around education. But we still lack the participation to make sure that those kids that we were talking about when we were dealing with these bills are actually performing at the levels that we think that is sufficient, and they're actually getting a high-quality education. And that goes beyond policy.
And when you're talking about participation, are you talking about parents participating in the schools, the policymakers themselves, the people leading the schools, everyone participating together?
Pretty much. Is what it is that you can see that everybody has a space. And, 40 years ago, we had a participation rate in the PTA at around 90%. Now it's around 5 to 10%. And you see, and my thing is that you see here in Wake County, Mecklenburg County, and some of the others, where local elected officials and local governments has been trying to participate participate. Then you see private business trying to participate. And then you see that the local community is also participating. My issue is that how do we bring all that together to make sure that we're creating the best capacity? How can a state government influence the local governments? How can local governments influence regular everyday people or even businesses? But everybody has a space, whether it's you're giving $1 million as a corporation or computers, or whether you're that that person in a community that can only afford to give $1 to make sure that someone has a book in their library, or being a lunch buddy or being a tutor. Everybody has a space that they can operate in this, and it's going to take everybody, because we have massive, massive problems. Even though we see numbers coming different ways, we see that we've dealt with teacher pay a little bit. We see that our graduation rates are coming up a little bit, but that doesn't mean that kids are college and career ready at that point. So we still have a massive operation that we're trying. It's a massive operation to try to take care of every single student in the entire state, from Antio to Murphy. That's a big operation. And 100 years ago, we decided that in the state of North Carolina, we wanted Little Anson County to look like Guilford County. So what we did was we created an environment of a top heavy down approach, where the state was going to take care of most of these needs. And now we see, as time has developed and we've got a lot more technology and a lot more things out there, that the state simply just does not have the capacity to do that alone. And we've got to be able to figure out a way that we can bring in more folks to be able to help participate and build bigger capacity.
We are chatting with Marcus Brandon. He is executive director of Carolina Can, also a former state legislator who dealt with these public school and charter school and school choice issues quite a bit. It sounds as if in some respects what you're talking about is making sure that people don't just sit back and say, well, the state's going to take care of this, or my school board's going to take care of this, someone else is going to take care of this, but getting more people involved and actually being part of the solution to improving schools.
Right, because we've got great policy, but what people don't understand is when they talk about what the state is doing and they blame the state. But North Carolina, the state of North Carolina, is actually eighth in what we produce in terms of financial output to our state schools. We are eighth in the country. We're not 45th and 49th in what people say. We have that number because of lack of local participation, and what I was talking about earlier about how the culture that we have, that the state is going to take care of everything. So, for example, in the state of Connecticut, they pay their teachers $28,000 a year. They're legislated. We pace that, and even though their teachers are number one in the country. So we have to look at the fact that the state is doing pretty much all it can do in terms of financial output. Whenever you're eighth, there's only seven states doing it better than we are. And so I think that we should be proud of what the state of North Carolina is producing for its public education. And we need to really take a look at where the other parts are missing. And that's from the local level, local businesses, and local people.
All right. So we have a limited amount of time left, but now I'm going to get to the tough question. You've identified the problem. What do we do about it now?
Well, the thing is that we have some solutions at the state level. I do believe it's incumbent upon the state, since we created that culture, that we actually kind of released that culture. And I know what environment that we're in. I don't believe that we need tax hikes or even allowing other folks to have taxing authority to be able to meet this. But I do believe that the state of North Carolina can incentivize public-private partnerships, much like you see Project Lift in Charlotte, much like you see the Wake County schools and how they decided they were going to get their teachers to national average. You see local governments trying to participate. And I think that if we can find a way through existing dollars that we have, that I know because I've been in the legislature, that doesn't necessarily do that work, but it's carved out for that work, how we can make sure that those people are receiving those incentives to make sure that we build bigger capacities. I think that's one place to start. But the other place is to just make sure basically we start talking about a different culture and a different mindset about how we view and how we approach education.
Is part of this also ensuring that a lot more decisions, as many as possible, get made locally, get made by parents or by individual schools?
Definitely. And that's what you see, the lack of participation, because we've abdicated that responsibility to state. A lot of people have not participated, and a lot of parents are not even encouraged to participate. It's more or less, we define quality education that you're going to drop my kid off at school, you're going to give them two lunches, and you're going to drop them off about in front of my house, and we deem that quality education, and they just abdicate that role. What we've got to do is change that culture that, no, you're still just as responsible for making sure that your child has a high quality education as the state and the local government does. And that's just going to local leaders and making sure that we allow space for that participation. Right now, they're not even really asked, and they're really asked to really stay away in so many senses with participation. If you don't allow them to choose their schools, and if you don't allow them to choose their course of education, then why would they come?
Well, it's a very interesting topic. It's certainly an interesting perspective, one in which we like to get as many people as possible involved in making sure that kids are doing as well as they can in the schools. Our guest has been Marcus Brandon. He is executive director of Carolina Can. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. After paying off a debt of more than $2.5 billion to the federal government for unemployment benefits, North Carolina is building up its unemployment reserves. State Senator Bob Rucho recently reminded colleagues that businesses are footing the bill.
This is an employer-based system, and they are there to pay the cost, backstop the system, and to be able to make sure that this benefit is available for North Carolinians that need this help.
Rucho also mentioned safeguards now built into the system.
When this system hits below the $1 billion, a red flag goes up. There's a new charge so that the employers are contributing to make sure that there is a continuous source, a backstop, to the fact that there is going to be sufficient resources available to be able to pay those benefits as need be.
The fund has grown to about $2 billion. Senator Andy Wells wonders whether that's enough.
Thankfully, we've got $2 billion sitting in the account that's protected. It appears that from 2012 to 2014, the trust fund balance dropped $2.1 billion. And at the same time, the FUTA penalty and the SUTA collections were going up $150 million each, so that's $300 million. So we effectively went through $2.4 billion in 2 years. So it's conceivable that $2 billion's not enough yet.
Ted Brin of the State Division of Employment Security responded.
You never know an amount that will absolutely positively be enough for every possible scenario. But when you get to a certain amount, $2.3 to $2.4 billion that relates to the formula, during that time we're also getting tax money coming in for that particular year. So it's not just the $2.3 or $4 billion that's insulating us against having to borrow. We're continuing to collect money all during that year from employers that's adding to that $2.3 or $2.4 billion. The combination of those two dynamics is our best chance of weathering storms through what we see for the last 20 years.
Brent says reserves of $2 billion should put North Carolina in a good position.
We can better project the kind of revenue coming in each year. Mm-hmm. So at any one time, if we're expecting to collect on or about $1 billion of tax revenue, maybe a little less some years, more other years, plus have our baseline at $2.3, $2.4 billion, that's about $3.3 billion, if I'm thinking right, mm-hmm. available to help us with our risk. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we could have $5 billion in the trust fund and feel very, very safe, but I expect there'll be conversations about when enough is enough and make decisions based on that.
You've been listening to Debate About North Carolina's Reserve Fund for Unemployment Benefits. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A recent article from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy targeted the topic Academic Freedom in the Age of Political Correctness. The article spurred a discussion among experts on the topic, among them Emory University English professor Mark Bauerlein. He says political correctness has been a problem for more than 25 years.
By and large, in the public sphere, political correctness of the academic kind was proven, demonstrated, shown to be an illiberal, coercive, bullying condition, and it was generally deplored in the public sphere. Since then, on college campuses, what we call political correctness has only gotten worse. My colleagues, many of them, most of them, sort of center-left, moderate liberals, are themselves actually never have been so fearful. Saying the wrong thing, doing the wrong thing, you never know when you're going to be recorded or filmed. And if you are, caught doing the wrong thing or just alleged to have been done the wrong thing, you go into what lawyers will call the system. All right? Suddenly it's turned over to a whole other machinery of federal regulations, Title VII, Title IX, issues, and the lawyers, it's in their hands now. Nobody wants to go there. And it only takes one case to make everyone else nervous. So this is where we are today. It's kind of a paradox. Everyone knows how bad this is, but it just keeps rising.
The Pope Center's Jay Shallon highlighted key themes from his report on academic freedom and political correctness.
There's sort of a great conundrum of academic freedom, and that is that if the absence of academic freedom tends to stifle knowledge and learning, so does total freedom, because you end up with a problem of activism. And activists deny the spirit of open inquiry. Their goal is political. They start with a political goal and accept or deny evidence according to whether it serves their needs to forward that goal.
Peter Wood of the National Association of Scholars has identified 7 elements of politically correct suppression of intellectual freedom. He ties those elements to the word outrage.
O for ostracize, U for usurp, T for train, R for repress, A for acidify, G for group, and E for exalt. Outrage. Ostracize those who dissent from political orthodoxy. Think of George Will being sent. You're no longer welcome here, note from the president of Scripps College, or numerous other disinvitations of our time. Usurp. Usurp what? Usurp the curriculum. Get rid of courses that no longer serve the purpose of the day. So the feminists at Springfield College in Massachusetts have decided that 6 or 7 courses on women in literature are perfectly good, but one on men in literature has to go. And the man who wants to teach it is now teaching 4 sessions of expository writing to freshmen at 8 a.m. in the morning. Usurpation of the curriculum is not normally what we think of first when we talk about political correctness, but it is the 7/10 of the iceberg below the water. That's where this stuff is really happening, what's not being taught and what is being taught.
That's Peter Wood of the National Association of Scholars discussing a recent report on academic freedom in the age of political correctness. He continued with his list.
T for train. That's train students to be activists. Get them to become community organizers. A major transformation of higher education is underway. We're about to release a report on this called Making Citizens. We make citizens now. By the moment the freshmen arrive, or first years as they're now called, arrive on campus, they are sent out to be volunteers. The students have a term for that. It's called volunteerany. Volunteerany is replacing the curriculum, and the people who support it make no bones about it. It's much more important to go to college to learn to be an activist, and that curricular stuff on the side, never mind, than it is to go there to become a learned person. R for repress. Repress refers to those topics that are ruled unfit for discussion. People know they're important, but they're unwilling to talk about them. When you are holding back your knowledge that the earth isn't heating up quite so much, the apocalypse that was promised for year 2000 and has been delayed a year ever since hasn't happened, you're engaged in a psychological process of repressing truth.
Peter Wood continued his list of politically correct elements based on the letters of the word outrage.
We're up to A. I didn't do very well with A. I came up with acidify, by which I mean that transformation of the campus into a place where people are really sour. Sense of, as my colleague Rochelle Peterson has called it, nudging. Every moment of the day you're being nudged to follow a particular path. Even if it's removing the trays from the cafeteria so you have to juggle 5 or 6 plates so you can think about sustainability while you try to eat your banana. That's what the acidify is. It's making the campus a safe place for the ideologues and an unsafe place for everybody else. G stands for group, and it stands for that we call it turning people into categories defined by race, sex, ethnicity especially, the racialization of campus into groups that are not only defined, but are defined in terms of their resentments, that dynamic has become a key part of the reign of political correctness. When you go to college, you're no longer an individual. You may have thought you were. You may have thought you were there to cultivate your individuality in some sense. But no, that's off the table now. You are who we tell you you are. And if you happen to be a white male, well, your job is to atone for the next 4 or 5 years.
What about the last letter in outrage?
E is for exalt, exalting certain ideas and beliefs so that they are exempt from questioning or critical examination. And expressions of dissent can be suppressed, therefore, as acts of malignity.
Brooklyn College history professor Casey Johnson noted disturbing recent trends in political correctness.
While the faculty are the primary thrust in terms of this internal threat to academic freedom, they're joined by administrators, increasingly powerful administrators in the student life, diversity, and Title IX bureaucracies. And more troublingly, they're increasingly joined by student bodies. The opening session of the Brown student government this year was declared a safe space. And as a result, the media were expelled from the deliberations. So the idea that uncomfortable ideas can not only not be discussed, but whenever ideas are discussed that you don't want people to hear about, outsiders can be excluded on grounds of safe space, suggests that the problem is more than just the faculty. It requires, to some extent, outside intervention. It certainly requires more aggressive oversight from trustees and alumni, who are, if we're going to stay within the system, are the groups that need to be far more active.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent debate about a report from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy. It's titled Academic Freedom in the Age of Political Correctness. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Whether or not North Carolina spends enough money on each child in public school is the subject of an ongoing debate. But there are also questions over how the amount we spend is actually determined. That was the subject of a recent legislative committee meeting, which looked at a new study compiled by the General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division. Dr. Terry Stoops is here to talk about that. He, of course, is the Director of Research and Education Studies for the Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
You've taken a look at this report. What'd you make of it?
This is an excellent report. This is a report by the Program Evaluation Division of the North Carolina General Assembly, and they were asked by the General Assembly to look at the way we fund public schools in North Carolina. Now, this certainly isn't the first time we've looked at this issue. In 2010, there was a report that was also commissioned by the General Assembly that looked at many of these same issues and came to some of the same conclusions about how the way we fund our public schools in North Carolina doesn't always make the best sense.
What jumped out at you about this report, a conclusion?
Well, I mean, one of the conclusions that we've known for some time is that the way we fund schools is not very transparent. It's not very clear to a casual observer how schools get their money. One of the more interesting points that they made was that even the business personnel for the school districts need around 4 or 5 years to learn the system. And if you have a system that is that complicated, that takes that much time to learn, then obviously there's a problem. And to compound that problem is that most business professionals at school districts don't spend or don't stay at the school district that long. So it takes a great deal of time to learn the system. And then by the time you learn it, those people have probably moved on.
Okay, this is a head scratcher for me because when I think about how the school system is funded and I think about per pupil allotments, we hear that phrase a lot, it seems to me that it would be kind of simple math. Here's the amount of money that is appropriated from the state, and there are other dollars that come into this as well from federal and local, but from the state, and then you divide it by the number of kids and voila, you've got yourself an amount of money. Not that simple?
I wish it were. just to put in perspective, the state spends about in 2014-15 around $8.5 billion. And the way that that money is sent to school districts is in the form of 37 allotments. And these are little pots of money for various things, whether it be classroom teachers, school supplies, any number of things. 37 pots of money that get sent to school district based on formulas that are created and maintained by the Department of Public Instruction. So if Carolina Journal would like to have a 37-part series where I can explain how we fund our public schools in North Carolina, I'd be happy to do so. But suffice it to say that it's a very complicated system that only a handful of people really, really understand.
Give us a couple of examples of what some of those little buckets of money are.
Well, for example, there's a bucket of money for special needs students. And this is one bucket that has been under scrutiny recently because it's a set dollar amount that school districts receive per child who has an individualized education plan. The problem is that it's capped at 12.5%. So if you're in a school system that has a particularly high percentage of students that are special needs, you can't get money for those students. Only up to 12.5% will you receive the $3,500 or so per student for special needs students. There's a pot of money for English as a second language students. Again, there are various pots of money. Some are much larger than others, such as the pot for special needs students tends to be much higher than some of the other pots of money, such as the money for small school districts or high need school districts tend to be a little smaller than that.
So there are people then whose job it is, I guess, in every school district to figure out what they qualify for. And that sounds like then they're going to have to somehow have a pretty detailed profile of each of their kids.
That's for sure. And not only that, you have districts with school finance personnel that are much more experienced than in other districts, and they know how to game the system. They know how to
they know every single
system.
One of those 37 pots.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And, because it's so difficult and complex, they are able to maximize the amount of dollars that their school system receives. Some of the other school districts aren't that fortunate and so receive much less money for around the same populations. And that's really one of the things that stood out to me is that there are school districts with similar populations that get vastly different amounts of money from the state. And most of that is because there are school district personnel that better know how to handle the system than others.
One of the headlines from this report is that wealthier counties are receiving more money than other counties. How is that possible if we have all of these different buckets of money for kids who have particular characteristics?
Well, one of the buckets of money is for teachers. And wealthier school districts tend to have teachers that are more experienced and have advanced degrees. And those are two factors that go in to determine how much money for classroom teachers these school districts get. So if you have a more experienced teacher workforce or you have a more credentialed teacher workforce, you're going to get more money per teacher than one that has less. And according to statistics, the wealthier school systems tend to have the more credentialed, more experienced teachers and therefore receive more money. Now, that one particular finding was something that angered a lot of those from rural school districts that don't tend to get as much money, but arguably need more money because of the way that their school system maintains its student population or some of the needs of the rural school systems aren't necessarily addressed. So, you know, this was one of the major findings that I think is going to propel changes in the way that we fund our school system.
Well, based on your description, it sounds like something does need to be done. So it's a good thing that the legislature is looking at this.
I'm actually thrilled that they're looking at this. We've been talking about the 2010 report that recommended changes since 2010 to urge the General Assembly to go ahead and look at this issue. But because of the Great Recession, because of the change from a Democratic to Republican legislator and then Democratic to Republican governor, there hasn't been a whole lot of urgency to look at our school funding system. Now there is, and I think that legislators are going to be motivated to do so.
Is there any low-hanging fruit, so to speak, in this whole complex system, Terry, a change or two that could be made fairly easily that would at least start the process of doing something about this?
Well, I think we need to look at what other states are doing, and increasingly they're looking at weighted student funding. Now, very few states use an allotment system like we do here in North Carolina, and instead they're going to a weighted student funding, which basically works like this. Each student in the state would receive a base amount of money, sort of like a starter fund, and based on their characteristics, there would be an additional amount of money laid on top of that base amount. So if they're a special needs student, if they're coming from a low-income family, then those students would receive an additional amount of money. This is a very easy and transparent way to go. It looks at what the students are, how many students you have, the characteristics of those students, and then funds the school system accordingly.
Lots more to come on this issue of how much we spend on public education and how those formulas work out to determine what these school districts are receiving. We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. You can read all of his analysis of this type of thing at carolinajournal.com and johnlock.org. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.